Good afternoon. This meeting of the Senate Resources Committee will come to order at 3:33 p.m. in the Butch Rich Room 205. Today is Wednesday, February 12th. I'd like to welcome Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, and Senator Rivak. I am Chairman Michiki. We have other members that will be late, but we do have a quorum to do business. Please silence your cell phones. Today we have two items on the agenda. The first is the Department of Law. They are going to present an overview of the cases that they've been working through that regard resources of the state of Alaska. Then we're going to move on to HB 122, the Thunder Bay Marine Park, Anangan Cemetery. So we'll start off with the presentation by the Department of Law, if you can please join us. With us today will be Chief of Staff to the Attorney General, Ed Sniffen, Assistant Attorney General, Jesse Alloway, and Assistant Attorney General, Mary Gramling. Say, pronounce that correctly, I hope?
Yes.
And if so, please feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Ed Sniffen, Chief of Staff to Attorney General Clarkson. In addition to Ms. Alloway and Ms. Hunter Gramling, the Attorney General is in the audience. So we appreciate the opportunity to give you a quick overview of some of the federal litigation that we're engaging in. We've done this for a few years now, and just to update this committee and the legislature on the litigation that we have going on with the feds and the status of that stuff. I believe you all have our summary chart. It's fairly lengthy. It's 13 pages, so we know you have business to get to today, so we're going to try to go through this stuff fairly quickly and not spend too much time on any one thing, but of course, if anyone has questions, just feel free to ask us. So we've divided this up in no particular order, so my colleagues will jump in on the cases that they've been assigned to talk to you about. And I'm going to start with a case that was pretty easy, and that's the Sturgeon case. I think most people are familiar with Mr. Sturgeon's efforts before the Supreme Court, not just once, but twice. Got a favorable result that found, the feds can't regulate state navigable waterways. So in May of last year, the AG actually sent a letter to the National Park Service asking them to amend their regulations to conform with the decision in the Sturgeon case. And then actually in September sent a formal petition for rulemaking to the Department of Interior asking them to change the specific language in their existing regulations to comply with the new mandates that the Supreme Court laid out in the Sturgeon case. We have heard from the Department of Interior that they're working on that. They have not yet promulgated a formal rule, but we understand that by the end of 2020, it's their intent to have a final rule in place, and so we'll be able to comment at that time as well. So that's the status of Mr. Sturgeon's case.
Just a question from me. Do you expect compliance?
Mr. Chair, by the Park Service or the Department of Interior, yes, we do. We expect that they will promulgate a rule that will change the language in order to conform with the Sturgeon decision. We know that right now that they are no longer enforcing federal regulations over waters where the state owns a submerged land, so they're already kind of acting that way. So we're hopeful that the rules will come out and they will conform with what the Supreme Court mandated in the Sturgeon case.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jesse Alloway, and the next subset of cases that I'm going to talk about all relate to our navigability program and the cases that we faced against the feds to determine who owns the submerged lands under waterways. Following what Mr. Sniffen said, I think that the Sturgeon case will make these lines of cases even more important, because in order for Sturgeon to apply, the state has to prove that it owns the submerged lands, and that's what these cases are about. When we have a disagreement with the United States, it generally falls into two categories. One, was there a pre-statehood withdrawal? In other words, prior to 1959, did the United States do something to keep the submerged lands for itself or to convey it to a private party? Or the second category of cases is whether the waterway is actually navigable in fact or tidally influenced. The next case on the chart is the Kuskokwim River case. That's a pre-statehood withdrawal issue. We've reached an agreement on a majority of the Kuskokwim, but there's a small section near McGrath that the feds claim was withdrawn via pre-statehood withdrawal for a military reservation. That military reservation was ultimately relinquished prior to statehood, and then it went back into basically general land status, is what my argument is. And so that wasn't a valid pre-state withdrawal. That's the state's position. We've briefed that issue. It's just waiting for a decision from the Interior Board of Land Appeals, which is the administrative body that hears these types of cases. We're still waiting for a decision. We've been waiting for a while. It's been pending since, I think, 2016. The next case is the Knik River case. Again, the feds had claimed that a portion of the Knik River from just below the glacier to the old Glen Highway Bridge was non-navigable, and they purported to convey that portion of the Knik to Aklutna. We challenged that by filing the quiet title action. Ultimately, the United States agreed with us and disclaimed their interest prior to getting too far into the litigation. The reason that it went up to the Ninth Circuit is I filed a motion for prevailing party costs, which was merely $425. We won that $425, but the United States wanted to appeal that. We engaged in some mediation prior to the case going forward. We weren't able to reach an agreement on the mediation, so ultimately the United States has dismissed its appeal, and I'm expecting the check for $425. So that case is ultimately finished. We're working on some issues dealing with 17B easements, but that's in an administrative process. The next issue on the chart would be the Middle Fork, North Fork litigation. We had filed what's called a 180-day notice to let the United States know that we intended to file a lawsuit on four rivers, two of which they changed their mind. That was the Denison Fork and the West Fork of the Denison Fork, and ultimately agreed with us that those were navigable. They disagree with us on the Middle Fork and the North Fork, so we filed a quiet title action. We're in the process of discovery. Both parties have now identified their experts. I imagine we'll do some depositions this spring, and I anticipate a trial probably next fall on that case. The final issue on the navigability list would be the Togiak Public Use Management Plan. This kind of relates to the sturgeon issue. Basically, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to promulgate some regulations to manage unguided use on the Togiak, which is a state-owned waterway. Those regulations kind of got held up with the sturgeon litigation. They haven't actually promulgated the new regulations, and we anticipate that this issue will be resolved once the Department of Interior publishes its new water regulations in compliance with the sturgeon decision.
Before we move on, Ms. Alloway, can you please explain the significance of navigability in these rulings? Why is that determination so important?
In these rulings? Because basically, under what's known as the equal footing doctrine, all states came into the union under the equal footing, under an equal footing. So all states are entitled to the submerged lands under their navigable and fact waterways. That's the significance of it. And this applies to, you know, Virginia just as much as it applies to Alaska. And the navigable and fact is just, it's a federal test that we apply. I'll break it down into basically what I say, and the United States, if they were watching this, would disagree with me. But can you float a boat that carrying 1,000 pounds? And by boat, I mean an inflatable raft carrying 1,000 pounds down that waterway. If you can do that relatively easily, then the state's position is that's a navigable, in fact, waterway, and the submerged lands belong to us rather than the feds.
Does a waterway have to pass that test at all stages of the tide and all seasons?
No, that would not be my position. In some prior litigation, the Mosquito Fork litigation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, we took the position that, you know, one-third of the open water season, so from May to the end of the September, if you can take that customary and ordinary watercraft down the waterway, one-third of the open water season, that's sufficient. And the Supreme Court has told us multiple times that it doesn't have to be easy. It can be difficult. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you hit a rock, if you have to get out and pull your boat, that's not going to defeat navigability. if you have to portage, maybe you have a problem. But none of the rivers that I'm talking about right now are we talking about a portage.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Questions, gentlemen?
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling. And so the next couple cases are going to be about land issues. And so the roadless rural case, the state of Alaska versus the Department of Agriculture, the current status of that case, it is for the Court of Appeals in the DC Circuit. And the case has been briefed on the merits. And in 2018, it was scheduled for oral argument. And then the environmental groups requested that the case be held in abeyance pending a petition for rulemaking that the Department of Agriculture granted. And so the court granted that motion for abeyance. The state did oppose that. And so every 90 days since late October, I think, 2018, the state has just been filing status reports with the other parties on the status of the rulemaking. We continue to object to the abeyance, but that's the status of that litigation hasn't really changed since we gave this presentation last year. As far as the petition for rulemaking goes, that was a petition that Governor Walker filed for the state in 2018, and the draft environmental impact statement was published in October of last year, and then the state and anyone else submitted comments on that draft in late December. The Department of Agriculture has indicated that they're planning to get a rule out by June 2020. Their preferred alternative was the alternative that the state requested, which would be full exemption for the Tongass. The state's position is that even if we get the full exemption for the Tongass, the rulemaking doesn't obviate the need for the litigation. We still want to continue with the litigation because we have claims against the roadless rule nationwide, statewide, Tongass-wide, and so the rulemaking doesn't, we'd still want to continue the litigation even if we get what we want for the rulemaking.
Thank you.
All right, and so then moving on to the next case on the chart is the Shelter Cove Road case. And those are two cases that are consolidated, and it's on the chart because we received a decision between this hearing last time, and the state in that case sought a number of declarations about Section 4407 easement corridors, and the U.S. District Court for the District of Alaska decision granted some of those declarations, the importance of which it increased the flexibility for the state's ability to site for road construction within those easements. And then it also declared that within those property rights, the state should have permanent access across the national forest lands, and that would include the Tongass. So it does help with the roadless rule issues somewhat there. And this case is important because it is another of a line of cases where we're really trying to preserve the state's infrastructure rights, particularly in the Tongass, to connect communities.
Just a quick question for you. When does resolved actually mean resolved?
So in this case, we have a district court decision that hasn't been appealed. To my knowledge, I'm not the primary attorney on the case, but it could be that when later phases of development happen that we have other litigation associated with that. But for right now, it's been resolved, and the declarations that we have in the case, I think, will be helpful for other cases going forward.
But like the Sturgeon Frost case, that can happen. I mean, you're potentially never resolved. You may have some forward motion, but someone can always bring back a suit in the future. I mean, does the Supreme Court ever say we're done?
Well, this was a district court decision, and it's a project that's, I don't believe it's finished yet. So, you know, when the project's finished, could be done. But for right now, this current round of litigation is finished, and I don't believe we have any other ones associated with the Shelter Cove Road at the moment.
All right, Mr. Chair, Jesse Alloway again for the record. In addition to the navigability issues, I also address issues of RS-2477, rights of way over both public and federal lands. The chicken litigation deals with a series of trails that leave Chicken to the north and ultimately end up going into wild and scenic corridors in the 40-mile area, both near Franklin Creek and Hutchinson Creek. To get to those trails, the terminuses of those trails, though, you had to go through a native allotment, and so there was sort of multiple things going on in this litigation. Through the native allotment, the courts held that they didn't have jurisdiction to address our claims of an RS-2477 right-of-way, so we ultimately had to condemn those lands in order to have a continuous right. That condemnation proceeding is now concluded in the district court, but this gets back to when is it resolved. It's done in the district court, but we have a Ninth Circuit appeal happening on that, and the state's brief is due next month. That's happening, but in addition, we are now proceeding against the federal government in the RS-2477s that we claim through their wild and scenic corridor. That's back down at the district court, and we're in discovery process. We've had some depositions last week. We'll exchange expert reports in a couple of months. And similar to the navigability cases, I'm anticipating a trial on that case probably next spring or late winter.
Can you share with us the best way to stay apprised of all of these cases for an Alaskan that may be interested in progress or lack thereof in some cases? What is the, you provided a great spreadsheet for us for this committee, but how do we stay in touch with cases as they go through the process?
That's an excellent question. I mean, at any point, if a member of the public has a question or wants information, they can always contact me, but the easiest way to contact somebody would be with the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit at DNR. I can't emphasize enough that the relationship between law and DNR on these cases are vital, and I can't prosecute the cases without the support that I get from that unit, and they know a lot about the information, and they would be glad to provide any member of the public with an update on the litigation as we move forward.
So to be clear, the reason for this meeting is to inform the public, but my secondary objective is to have them care. They are their rights that have been compromised since prior to statehood, certainly since statehood, and it matters. It matters on how we live our everyday life. So what you're doing is very important. I know there are folks on various sides of various aisles that may be some of the supporters of some of the federal decisions, but I think that's an important part of the discussion for Alaskans as well. So I would love to keep them informed as these cases progress, however it's easiest, and maybe we have a spreadsheet that's, I'm sure you probably keep one. You're busy, but maybe something we can share with the public twice a year or something like that, just so they sort of keep it at the forefront.
Mr. Chairman, too, Ed Sniffen again for the record. So this particular chart is one that we do update at least twice a year, if not more, and it's posted on our website. So the public can always access this information to get some summary information, and we do try to update it frequently. So.
Thank you.
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling. So the next case on the chart is the current litigation for the road connecting King Cove and Cold Bay. And I believe last year when this presentation was given, we were in a position as an amicus and to support that exchange agreement. That exchange agreement was invalidated, and King Cove Corporation and Interior negotiated another exchange agreement, and that exchange agreement has also been challenged in this round of litigation, the state decided to weigh in as an intervener in support of the defendant federal government. We moved to intervene in January. That motion was granted, I think, about 2 weeks ago, and we should be filing our brief in March. And then the next case on the chart isn't a litigation, but it's a plan, and it's a Tongass land management plan. And the state, our alignment right now is a little bit uncertain on that one because the petition for rulemaking process is underway and the roadless rule litigation is pending. And so for the moment, the state isn't taking any action on the 2016 Tongass land management plan because we want to see how those other two avenues that we're pursuing pan out. When the plan was finalized, though, we did file objections, so we have preserved our ability to take further action if needed.
Can you move back a case to the Eisenbeck Road on the term aligned in that case? You're aligned because of the decision or because of your the land exchange agreement? You're not aligned to the current challenge. How do you define alignment in that case?
So in that case, the environmental groups have challenged the federal government's decision to enter into the exchange, and so we have entered the case in support of the federal government ability to enter that exchange.
And the column is simply about alignment to the feds?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And then moving on to the 2019 Chugach Land Management Plan. This is one where we are not aligned at the moment. However, there is not a final record of decision yet, and so pending the final record of decision, that would be the time when we would evaluate what options the state would consider for going forward. Part of the issue with that land management plan and some other plans that are in this chart is that the federal government, sometimes they'll have some sort of national rule that they want to impose on Alaska, and maybe they haven't considered ANILCA provisions like they should. And for the record, when I say ANILCA, I mean the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
Thank you. I want to announce that Senator Bishop has arrived. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry.
It's okay.
Mr. Chairman, Ed Sniffen, again, for the record, I'm going to talk about these next two cases briefly. I'm not the attorney on these cases, so I don't have as much detail as I'd like, but I'd be happy to answer whatever questions we can. So the Eastern Interior Resource Management Plan. This is a BLM land management plan for a very large area that contains smaller disconnected BLM units, including the Steeves and White Mountains areas and the 40 Mile and Black River regions. And the plan is problematic because it contains land that was withdrawn from the federal public domain under ANCSA, the Alaska National Lands Conservation Act, and is close to mineral development. So when those lands were withdrawn, they were kind of taken, you know, off the shelf for Alaska to, you know, provide any kind of non-conservation, you know, purposes for them. And these withdrawals were originally made in 1971. To prevent third-party rights from being created while ANCSA selections were being made. But then in 2004, after passage of the Alaska Lands Transfer Acceleration Act, or ALTA, Congress directed the Department of Interior to identify lands that should be lifted from those withdrawals, and the BLM identified about 50 million acres that should be, you know, lifted and be available for the state. And the first withdrawals were lifted in 2018 in the Good News Bay area, and then additional withdrawals were lifted in 2019 in the 40 Mile and Bering Glacier areas. But most of the state's highest priority statehood selections are still hampered by the remaining withdrawals that have not been lifted. And so we are focused on getting BLM to lift those withdrawals. And so that's another one of those where it's uncertain We're not necessarily aligned with the feds because they're not moving as quickly as we'd like them to remove those restrictions so we can pursue perhaps mineral development or the uses of that land. And then this this next matter is the lands into trust matter. I think most of you are probably familiar with some of that history. So there was a case here in Alaska, the Akichak case, that came out in, I think, 2013 or 2014, that found that allotments could be taken into trust in Alaska. And then in the DOI changed its regulations in 2014 to allow those lands to be taken into trust. And then in 2018, the Department of Interior rescinded a solicitor's opinion on which the Department of Interior relied to have that happen. And so since that was rescinded, the DOI stated it wasn't going to process any new applications to take those lands into trust. But the rule hasn't been changed yet. It's still out there. So the DOI hasn't initiated a new rulemaking process yet. They've asked for comments about the rule, and the state submitted comments last year about that. And the comment period is closed in March of last year. We don't know when the Interior will issue a new solicitor's opinion or if they're going to open up a new rulemaking, so we're just watching that. But we know that they're not processing any new applications to take lands into trust, but they have stated they will continue to process the ones that had been submitted before that happened. But I haven't, we're not aware of any action that's been taken on any of the pending applications. So that's kind of in limbo right now, and we're trying to work with DOI to find out if we can get some, you know, direction on when they think they're going to have either a new rule in place or a solicitor's opinion.
So when you say that the BIA has granted the Craig application, does that mean that there are lands in trust in the state of Alaska, and that is the Craig application is the?
Yes. Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's an approximate 1 acre parcel of land in Craig that has been taken into trust, and that is, that is one of the pieces that, and I think that is the only one in Alaska.
Is that purposely a test case of some sort?
Mr. Chair, no. I think it just happened to fall in that zone where they were accepting applications. There was a period of time where they were acting on them. Their application was submitted, comments were made, and that application was approved. Then after that one, the solicitor's opinion was withdrawn, and pending applications haven't been processed since.
Thank you.
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling. And so the next case concerns an Arctic National Wildlife Refuge boundary dispute between the state of Alaska and the Bureau of Land Management. The case has probably been on this chart for quite a while. The administrative body that decides decisions for the Department of Interior, the Interior Board of Land Appeals, they have about 7 pages of cases that they list as pending and under review. And this case is on the first page. I don't know if that means we'll have a decision sooner rather than later, but it hasn't really changed anything since last year. Once the state tried to get expedited consideration of that appeal, and that was denied. And the reason that the Bureau of Land Management also wanted expedited consideration of that appeal is because the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act authorized them to consider opening the ANWR 1002 area to oil and gas leasing, and whether or not the acreage that's in dispute in this boundary appeal will be included in that offering is in question, and BLM's preference would be to have the dispute cleared up so that they know whether or not they can lease those acres. Obviously, the state would also, we would like the acres. But so that's the status of that appeal. And then the next.
Ms. Gramling, Senator Bishop, I had a question as well.
You go first and I'll go second.
Maybe the same question.
My question is, we're saying that it's our 20,000 acres, and that's what we're trying to bring to closure. We're claiming the 20,000 acres. As my understanding is, this has been around a while. And am I right that we're claiming it's ours?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, this is a case where we're not aligned, but both parties were aligned in trying to get the appeal to be resolved. The state would obviously like it resolved in our favor.
Thank you.
Yes, we had the same question. So the feds would not, if there were conveyance, the state of Alaska would be managing a lease sale and not
BLM.
Not BLM.
That is correct.
Thank you.
And so the next case on the chart is, it's not actually a case, it's the state's commenting on potential oil and gas lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the state submitted comments, and we're really just waiting at this point in time for a record of decision and final environmental impact. Actually, they have a final environmental impact statement. We're waiting for a record of decision. And then after a record of decision, the federal government can move forward with leasing.
Mr. Chair, Ed Sniffen again. On page 6, I wanted to talk briefly about the Native Village of Iklutna versus United States. This is a fairly new case for us, and it's in litigation, so we can't talk about it too much, but I'm happy to tell you what it's about. The Native Village of Iklutna requested a determination from the Department of Interior that a certain allotment was Indian lands for purposes of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, or IGRA, I-G-R-A. And the department denied the request primarily on the grounds that the plaintiffs don't have jurisdiction to exercise governmental powers over these allotments as required to meet IGRA's definition of Indian lands. We have intervened in the case on the side of the decision to also hold that those allotments do not meet that test. It has broad-reaching applications for a lot of allotments in Alaska and the state's authority to control gaming activity and receive funds from that activity on allotment land across the state. So that's where we are with that. We just recently were granted our motion to intervene here, and we have activities coming up in that case, and we'll see where it goes.
Can you just quickly describe, this has some relationship to the difference between allotments and lands in trust, is that correct?
Through the chair, there is a difference. So, you could maybe take an allotment and put it in trust, and it has the character of, Indian country or Indian land for those purposes. But under IGRA, it's a definition of Indian lands. It's different. It's not trust land, but it's lands that would allow federal government to, and the tribes to control the gaming conduct. So a little different status, but a lot of the similar effect, yes.
I guess I'm asking about sort of the difference in Alaska. I mean, there are a lot of Indian lands across the U.S. Mm-hmm. where gaming occurs. Mm-hmm. What is the difference here?
Through the chair, I might not be the expert on that, but I'm going to give you a guess. But if I'm wrong, we can correct that for you later. So, of course, across the country, there is Indian reservation land that was, usually established through treaties and settlements. Go back hundreds of years. In Alaska, we settled a lot of Indian claims through ANCSA, but Native allotments were allotments that, continued to be held in fee by, the landholders. The status of those allotments as Indian land, Indian reservation land, or Indian country has never really been decided. And so those are issues that we continue to take a look at when the opportunity arises. I think there have been a couple of cases that have touched on that issue, but I don't know if we've had an Alaska Supreme Court opinion that's affirmatively said, one way or another, whether or not those allotments should be treated that way.
Yeah. Thank you.
And this next case that's on the top of page 7 is the Regional Hays State Implementation Plan rule. So the state has intervened in a case to challenge the 2017 Regional Hays State Implementation Plan rule. And what that really means is there's a rule that requires that we impose conditions on emissions that contribute to regional haze that affects visibility in national parks and different wilderness areas. The problem is, visibility issues and haze comes from pollution caused internationally, right? And it blows over towards us. And these rules actually are, impose upon the state requirements that are just for things that are beyond the state's control. And so we've intervened to challenge those rules to see if we can make them a little less onerous for the state to have to comply when it's not our pollution sources that are causing the issues that we're having to deal with. The case right now is on appeal before the U.S. District Court, and it's been paid. It's been stayed pending some review by the EPA of its rule. They're looking to maybe tweak it or change it in some way to make it a little less burdensome on the states. So we're working with EPA on those rules right now to see if we can come to some compromise. And if we don't get to some place where we're happy, then we'll lift that and the appeal will go forward.
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling. So the next two items on the chart are related. The Clean Power Plan regulations were never applicable to Alaska, but at the time the EPA proposed those rules, there was some indication that in future they might be. And so that's why that's marked as uncertain alignment. And then more recently, the Affordable Clean Energy Rule took effect and repealed the Clean Power Plan regulations. The state of Alaska, we joined with some briefing that was drafted primarily by West Virginia in a case that seeks to defend the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. And our interest in that, maintaining that rule, is that it supports Alaska's long-standing primacy in regulating electrical utilities and just cooperative federalism, that you know the state should take a lead role in that, whereas the Clean Power Plan, in our view, wasn't consistent with cooperative federalism.
What were the reasons they excluded Alaska and Hawaii originally, and can they just sort of at will in the future include another state that they excluded in a final rule?
So in a rulemaking process, they would have to propose a rule to include Alaska. But right now, since the Clean Power Plan regulations have been appealed or repealed, doesn't seem likely at the moment, at least with this administration, that Alaska is really under much risk of that right now, but it's one of those issues that we would monitor. And then the briefing in the New York versus EPA case, the state's briefing would be due in June. We'd probably be not the primary drafters of that, though, since we're aligned with, I think, about 20 other states in that case.
Mr. Chairman, I am Jesse Alloway again for the record. I'm going to talk about what is known as the WOTUS rule, or the Waters of the United States rule. Basically, Waters of the United States, the federal government has the authority to, or the jurisdiction to regulate that under its Commerce Clause powers. So if it's a water of the United States, the federal government could regulate the water, for example, under the Clean Water Act, and require permits for point discharges and things like that. Since the Obama administration, we've been litigating how the federal government defines water of the United States. The Obama administration had a very expansive view of that, and from the state's perspective, they didn't adequately take into consideration regional or temporal fluctuations in the water level, which gave the federal government jurisdiction over lots of wetlands in Alaska, as well as isolated areas of permafrost. So basically, the federal government was expanding its jurisdictional reaches. We filed a lawsuit to challenge that rule. That rule has been stayed, and in the meantime, the EPA has issued a new rule. Well, there was actually a two-step process. They pulled back the Obama administration rule, and they've now issued a new rule defining waters of the United States. That came out earlier this month, and the department is now in the process of analyzing that rule, and maybe we'll provide some additional comments to the EPA. Questions? All right, then the next thing that I'm going to talk about is basically it's the next two cases. It's the NPS and Fish and Wildlife Service rules, as well as the Congressional Review Act case. It deals with a series of rules that both the National Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service issued in 2015 and 2016. The heart of the dispute really is there's a disagreement between the state and those two agencies over what predator control is. The state views predator control like as intensive management, where state personnel would go out and actually actively take predators for the purposes of managing populations. The federal government views simple hunting regulations like the taking of brown bear over bait to be predator control. So those rules basically forbid those state regulations on federal land, so all national park preserves as well as fish and wildlife refuges. The state filed a lawsuit in conjunction with Safari Club and the Alaska Hunters Professional Hunters Association shortly after those regulations were implemented. And once the Trump administration came into office, they used what's called the Congressional Review Act to take back the 2016 Fish and Wildlife Service rule. So that rule is no longer valid per the Congressional Review Act. But the Congressional Review Act, you can only use in a certain time frame. So Congress couldn't use the Congressional Review Act to invalidate the National Park Service rules. So those still are outstanding. And where we're at with the litigation now is we are continuing to litigate the validity of the National Park Service rules. The Fish and Wildlife Service rules are no longer valid, and there's been cross motions for summary judgment filed on the Park Service rules. But then what happened was an environmental group challenged Congress's use of the Congressional Review Act to invalidate the Fish and Wildlife Service rules. And that case was also litigated, and it recently went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed that decision. So the Congressional Review Act case is resolved. I'll use Mr. Chair's word. That case is resolved. Those rules are no longer valid, but we are continuing to challenge the Park Service rules.
Yeah, Senator Rivak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are the Park Service rules? How do they differ? I'm sorry. Thank you so much. What are the Park Service rules there, and how do they differ? What exactly are you challenging there? Can you please explain that to me?
Sure. Senator, through the chair. Well, I say sure because, but unfortunately, I'm not going to remember the details of the rules off the top of my head, so I'll have to get back to you. But the heart of it is what we consider to be predator control, right? So the Board of Game would hear various proposals from members of the public. And one of them that comes to mind was some native groups wanted to subsistence hunt by taking black bears in the den. The Board of Game heard that, said, yes, that's valid, and authorized that per the hunting regulations. But the federal government sees the taking of black bears in their den to be predator control. So they've disallowed that use on federal land. So that's the conflict. And I think there were other things like the taking of brown bear over bait that were authorized under state law that are not invalid. And then if memory serves me, we might have changed the hunting season for things like wolves, another predator that the federal government viewed to be predator control. Those are not all of the examples, but those are the ones that kind of come to the top of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Certainly.
Just to be clear, that the National Park Service doesn't allow any predator control?
That's the Park Service, through the chair. Yes, that's the Park Service's position.
Okay, thank you so much.
Could I just make a comment on that?
Absolutely, Senator Bishop.
So I think you said that the Park Service does not allow any predator control. Is that what you said?
Yes.
And you said yes?
Yes, through the chair. Yes, Senator, that is the Park Service's position.
Well, there's been some cases on the Aleutians on some federal ground where I think the federal government has eradicated some certain species. So I don't think it's a blanket no. Just FYI.
Can you talk about the relationship with the sustained yield clause in the Constitution and how that's problematic in this case? I know the National Park Service policies, the Department of Justice is taking that position that it preempts our constitutional management through sustained yield. Is that important in this case? Is that sort of the crux of this case? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I do know, and yes, it is important. As you said, Fish and Game manages all wildlife populations under the sustained yield guideline. Part of the argument that we are raising in this litigation is that the federal government exercised its jurisdiction to preempt us without any biological studies. The populations that we were managing, there's no concern about the populations. There's plenty of animals out there, and the state was not managing it for the purpose of reducing the number of predators in order to allow the prey population to increase. That was not the purpose of what Fish and Game was doing. And so that argument that you're making is absolutely true, is that it's hampering our ability to maintain all populations for a sustained yield.
And their ability to define predator control could extend into the taking of any predator for any reason in the future. If they're able to create their own definition, if they were to win this case, we're at their mercy on the definition of something we're unable to do in 80% of the lands in Alaska if they decided to expand to all federal lands. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's a logical argument that one could make, yes, depending on how the court wants to define predator control.
Okay.
Well, now that I've thoroughly depressed all of you, I'll go on and talk about the Salmon Fishery Management Plan. So this is one where we were actually aligned. There was an amendment that the federal government issued that removed federal oversight for lands within what is known as the EEZ, the Exclusive Economic Zone. A party challenged that. We intervened in order to support the federal rule. We ultimately lost that at the court level, and we petitioned for cert with the United States Supreme Court. That was denied. What's happening now is the federal government's been ordered to issue a plan, and that plan is due at the end of this year. There's been a little bit of activity in the case recently because the party that won has filed a motion to enforce judgment. They basically want immediate action, and the district court denied that motion and said, no, you have to wait. The federal government has until the end of the year to issue that new plan, and so we're continuing to monitor the litigation as it goes forward.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess I keep going. 2008 mining claims rule. Again, in this case, we were aligned. The federal government had issued some rules which eliminated the regulatory hurdles for some miners, and an environmental group challenged those 2008 mining regulations. We intervened, in addition to a number of states, on behalf of the federal government, and briefing has been done, oral argument is done. We're just waiting for a final decision on that one. And then the next issue that we will talk about is the Comprehensive Environmental Response, so Compensation and Liability Act. That's CERCLA. Again, we are aligned. The federal government issued some regulations that reduced the amount of regulatory hurdles that someone had to overcome. An environmental group challenged that, and Alaska, along with other 13 other states, have intervened on behalf of the federal government. That case is currently being litigated in the District of D.C. Actually, I'm sorry. This one's I'm not as familiar with. The court has deferred to the EPA's interpretation of the regulation, and no petition for cert has been filed. So this is actually a case that has been resolved. So there's some good news for you.
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling. So the next item on the chart, the Wishbone Hill Mine. I don't have much to add other than the chart has an acronym in there, OSMRE, and that stands for the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. And that is an office of the federal government, and how the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, SMCRA, as it's commonly referred to, works is that if a state's regulatory program and laws are, I guess, consistent with SMCRA, then a state can have primacy. And so Alaska has primacy over surface mining control as long as our programs is consistent with what the Office of Surface Mining and Reclamation and Enforcement Act. And so I believe this Wishbone Hill Mine issue concerned a state permit, and so we entered that to really just enforce our primacy. And at this time, I don't believe that the Office of Surface Mining and Reclamation Enforcement group has any issue with the state's program at this time. The next item on page 12 of the chart, the Trump versus League of Conservation Voters Act, that case is currently in the Ninth Circuit in the briefing stage. And I'll just say a little bit about Alaska's interest in that case. It's because Alaska has more coastline than the rest of the states. And so the Outer Continental Land Shelf issues are very important to us. And that case concerned withdrawal under that act of certain lands from leasing. And so Alaska's position in the case is that the Outer Continental Land Shelf Act, you know, benefits, or one of the goals of the act was to benefit Alaska's infrastructure and economy. And so that's our interest in the case.
So on that particular, in that language, is it actually as loose as saying permitting a president to, from time to time, withdraw unleased lands?
Yes, it does say that. And so most of our briefing is about what from time to time means and various other congressional acts that use that term. The state's position and the federal government's position were aligned in this case, is that from time to time, if that's in a statute, that really means that it's a revocable thing or something temporary, that so one president can do it and then another president can change it. That's our position, is that when something has that from time to time language in there, that's not to meet a permanent withdrawal or a permanent grant of anything.
Sort of like the same threshold as substantially similar. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ed Sniffen again. For the record, I'm going to close out our presentation by talking about these last two cases on our chart. On page 13 at the top, we have an Endangered Species Act case pending in California. A few years ago, Alaska joined about 15 other states in a lawsuit challenging EPA rules that expanded the types of areas that can be designated as critical habitat. And under those rules, there was little, if any, connection to the presence of the listed species. For example, Alaska polar bears, ring seals, and other populations that are currently very healthy, you know, in Alaska were listed as threatened based on climate change models going out 50 and 100 years, right, into the future. So that lawsuit was dismissed, and some new rules were proposed that were much more reasonable. And those new rules became final in 2019, and Alaska joined 12 other states to intervene to help defend the new rules. They're under attack by some environmental groups right now. And those new rules still require the designation of critical habitat, and they also define what it means to be threatened in a much more reasonable way. You know, for example, the critical habitat designations have to be based on the best scientific data available, but clarifies that areas can be excluded if habitat is threatened solely from causes that cannot be addressed through the management action. So, for example, If climate change causes sea levels to rise, management actions may not be able to address those issues. So in those areas, they could be excluded from the critical habitat, you know, sort of designations. So, and they also clarify some other things dealing with, you know, that unoccupied areas can be designated as critical habitat, but they allow specific areas outside of occupied areas by species to be designated only upon a determination that such areas are essential for the conservation of the species and will only be considered essential where limiting the critical habitat to the occupied area would be inadequate to ensure the conservation of the species. So the new rules are fine, and so we're in court trying to defend those. And then this last case on here deals with some seismic testing in Cook Inlet. The National Marine Fisheries Service gave permission to Hillcorp Alaska to conduct some seismic testing in Cook Inlet, the Cook Inlet keeper and some others sued challenging that decision, claiming that you know, the beluga whales are threatened or endangered, and there wasn't being enough done to protect that species. So the National Marine Fisheries Service decision is one that we are defending, and we've moved to intervene in that case. The record has been certified, and we're waiting for further action and further activity in that case. But that's what that one is about, permission to do that seismic testing.
Thank you. General questions on our presentation today on the list of federal issues and conflicts? I have one sort of a light question, but does alignment with the feds sometimes change with administrations?
Through the chair, my colleagues are looking at me. Maybe I should look to the Attorney General to answer that one. Yes, it can.
I actually got a thumbs up. Yes. Okay, well, thank you so much for that. And if we have any follow-up questions, we can certainly get them to you and ask you to distribute it to the committee. But thank you so much, all three of you, for your time today. And for we will look for your link. Perhaps you can email it over to the office, and we can get it out for the public to keep up with us.
Certainly will, Mr. Chairman.
You're busy. One last question, actually, before you. We have a pretty heavy caseload. How much is that associated with our state being an infant state with an agreement such as ANILCA and some of the other agreements that we're going through, as opposed to sort of older, longer-term states that might have some of these land and water issues settled? Or is this a common thing across the U.S.?
I'll take a stab at that, Mr. Chairman, and then I'll let my colleagues chime in. So we are fairly unique in a lot of ways. As Ms. Underground mentioned, we have more coastline than anyone else, so we're get involved in issues that other states may not get involved with. We have ANCSA up here that no other state has, so a lot of those issues are unique to Alaska. We do have some unique statehood issues that result, like the navigability issues that Ms. Alloway is working on, for example. They're not uncommon in other states, but I think for whatever reason they seem to be more prolific here than other places. So a good chunk of this stuff, I don't know if I have a percentage for you, but a good chunk of it is because just Alaska is unique and new.
I have a question, Mr. Is this a curiosity related to the Kinnick River Clutna Incorporated selection application? Would you happen to know how much the federal government might have spent trying to get their $400 back in that case? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. No.
How long did, Mr. Chairman, how long did that go on for?
Over a year, I think.
Really?
I think we started the mediation before, in the last administration, and it's gone through Attorney General Clarkson. So, yeah, over a year.
Wow. Thank you.
I think the easy answer is more than $400 worth. Longer
that would be
than
correct, yes.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
We're now going to move to the bill we have before us today, the HB 122 Funner Bay Marine Park Onongan Cemetery. I don't know that we need to take a brief at ease, but if we can have Representative Hannah Hannon and her staff, Hunter Meekum, up here to give us a sort of brief refresher of the bill, if you don't mind, and we'll move into public testimony at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Sarah Hannon.
For the record, Hunter Meacham, staff to Representative Hannon.
And because I have taken all the glory for this young woman's work, I'm going to have her present today.
Thank you. Again, Hunter Meacham for the record. House Bill 122 would transfer land from the Division of Land, Mining, and Water to the Division of State Parks for land management and for protection of the cemetery in Funter Bay, where around 30 marked graves are and a number of unknown grave sites. And at no additional state or cost to the state, the Department of Natural Resources, Division of State Parks and Recreation would take that on for land management.
Any questions for the representative or Ms. Meacham? Am I saying that properly?
It's Meacham.
Meacham. Yeah. Seeing no questions, thank you for bringing this back. We're going to take public testimony at this time. In the packet are letters from many entities interested in seeing this bill pass, understandably. I think this is a very important bill, and I'm looking forward to hearing from the public for public testimony. So if you can please, for the one person who's ready to testify, be on the left. The next person, be ready on the right. And then introduce yourself for the record, and please provide your public testimony.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Zaharoff. Senators?
Yes.
I represent the communities of St. Paul and St. George Island. I'm also a tribal council member and represent the corporation as well. We all have some representatives here from the Pribilof Islands. I'd like to announced Zeev Malavidov, one of our elders. Jacob Merkulyev, our mayor of St. Paul Island. Sarah Edelin, she worked with the tribal council and worked with Fish Wildlife Service to do a timeline story about what happened in Funter Bay. Also, I'm going to be very brief. I know you heard from Martin Stepton earlier. We're also working with Curator Nico here with the museum. I'm just going to be brief, you know, the whole story about Funter Bay, you know, 10% of our population passed away down there. So the importance of this House Bill 122 would be something that our communities would be looking forward to due to the fact that we would have protection and preservation of this burial site, you know, for our loved ones and family members that perished down there. And I hope you guys pass House Bill 122.
And for the record, I'm Nico Sanguinetti. I'm the curator of collections and exhibits at the Juneau Douglas City Museum. I've been working with a group here in Juneau of various community members and with folks from St. Paul and St. George to work on not only this bill, but more recognition regarding the internment camps at Funter Bay. I know that several other people have testified about their history. You probably don't need to hear it again from me, but it is a very important part of our state history, and it's an important part that not everyone knows about. We're working at the museum to do our largest exhibit of the year over the summer on the internment camps at Funter Bay. They are just right around the corner, and there is a piece of history with the cemetery still there that can be preserved, especially for generations to come who can actually visit their family members. And I know one of the big questions often is the resources around the cemetery and the amount of space that's being given. And from a historic preservation standpoint, not even from a respect standpoint, it's generally good policy to have a sort of buffer zone around any place you're trying to protect, just in case there's any kind of ground disturbance or problems that can arise from heavy machinery nearby. So one of the great things about having that small bubble of buffer with that state park is that not only will the cemetery itself be preserved, but the area around it, so it's going to limit more destruction in the future. Well, thank you very much for hearing us today. We're very grateful to be here.
Thanks for being here. Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else willing to testify on HB 122? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joel Bennett. I'm from Juneau, also a property owner in Thunder Bay, and my 3 acres are essentially abutting the cemetery in question here. And I want to just offer the perspective that in the over 30 years that I've owned this property and used the area, sometimes as much as a month and a half, a year, I really see no conflict here with any other state interests in terms of resource. I'm intimately familiar with the area around the cemetery. It's essentially low-quality timber, and much of it is bog meadow and scrub land. I'm positive it's considered low value for any kind of timber harvest efforts. The mining, of course, has been a part of Admiralty Island, since the 1930s, but none of the claims or development areas associated with that mining on the Mansfield Peninsula are anywhere close to the cemetery or the lands described in HB 122. And the mining that has happened in Funter Bay proper has been essentially little or no development since the 1930s. This area is further recognized by the U.S. Forest Service and its land use designation plan as essentially recreation, remote recreation, and not it's not ever been considered for resource development for timber harvest. So I think in summary, from the perspective of perhaps the closest landowner to the cemetery, I don't see a conflict. I see a great step forward that the state might take to recognize, the sad history, but nevertheless the significance of the graveyard to the Pribilof people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bennett. I will tell you that when we first brought this bill up, I had some concerns about some of the surrounding property being brought into the park area and cemetery, and asked many of the questions that you answered today. I'm have become satisfied that it's the right move. I do think it's my responsibility to ask those questions, as this committee is looking out for all Alaskans and not just those at Admiralty Island. But I have learned very much about the situation with the people from St. Paul and St. George in their experience in Funner Bay. And I think it's a very important bill. I'm not concerned any longer about transferring that land to a more appropriate management department. So I appreciate that. That was sort of what I was looking for in my evaluation, and I'm fairly convinced that it's the right move the way the bill's written. Thank you. Are there other members of the committee that would like to, or I'm sorry, are there other members of the public that would like to testify? No? Okay, seeing none, I am going to close public testimony. Are there other comments from committee members? Seeing none. What is the will of the committee? Senator Bishop?
We're ready to move the bill.
Oh. Yeah. I was going to make a motion, but I'll let Senator Bishop.
I think that would be appropriate for Senator Keel to move the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I move that we report House Bill 122, which is 31 LS 0637/U.A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the bill will move from committee. Please stick around to sign the report on its way out. I want to thank our LAO moderator today, Brett Mello, and Chris Dickrell with Senate Records, and my staff, Conrad Jackson, for their work today. As there is no further business to come before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 4:45 p.m.